The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guests today on Getting the Yes And are Tehama Lopez Bagnasi and Candace Watts Smith. Tehama is assistant professor of conflict analysis and resolution at George Mason University. Candace is associate professor of political science and African American studies at the Pennsylvania State University. They have co-authored a new book. It's called Stay Woke: A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Happy to be here.
One of the important takeaways that I got from your book is that we not only have a race problem in America, to put it mildly, but we have a talking about race problem in America. And you write, quote, "An overwhelming proportion of people we talk to genuinely value the idea of a racially equitable society, but they are uneasy about talking about racism." I think I know why, but tell us what you know about why.
I think the first thing that comes to mind, really, is that people are afraid of being labeled a racist by the sheer act of talking about race. And I think the reason why they even think this to begin with is because the kind of colorblind ideology that has been sweeping the nation for a few decades now is paints race. We see it as a way that organizes society, and you know, often for the worse, right?
Mm-hmm.
As itself, just to even acknowledge it, that is the problem, is acknowledging it. So if you talk about it, then you're perpetuating the problem, which then makes you a racist, right? That's the logic there, and so people who want, you know, they want equality, they want people to feel safe. I think they feel awkward, you know, in having this conversation, and you know, let alone if your racial identity is white, right, and you're entering the space talking about racism, and then there's already, you know, the idea of whiteness being a stigmatized identity as far as being a racist. So it's a whole thing going on there.
Yeah, and we know. I mean, the thing we know about improvisation is you can't improvise well if you're in your fear brain. You stop listening. Mm-hmm. You become less others focused because you're focused just on yourself, and that makes you really unable to connect in the world. And I think for a lot of people, they can't approach this topic without fear. And it's something that I think that what you're calling for in the book is a bit of fearlessness on the behalf of our entire community to talk about this problem and to understand it at its root.
Right. At least at the very, if not fearlessness, then courage.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word. I think the other thing I headlined my notes, and this is why. That was the headline here. But one of the problems is, you point out, is the story we tell ourselves about race in America. And I'll quote you from the book. "The congratulatory stories we tell ourselves treat the existence of the Underground Railroad and the Civil Rights Movement as an emblem of the American people's freedom-fighting spirit, rather than as an emblem of the deeply ingrained racism that these folks sought freedom from." That's a powerful sentiment.
Well, I mean, the thing is that Americans, generally speaking, are really progress oriented. We always want to see progress, and we never really want to acknowledge when we're not making progress. And so, you know, this kind of the story we tell ourselves is one of national redemption. It's one of we've been there, done that. And so it's, I think it's just a hard pill to swallow for some of us that we have to do more. But I mean, in our everyday lives and our businesses and our studies, you know, we all want to improve, but in order to improve, in order to do better, we have to take note of those places where we're weak, where we're faltering, or where we haven't done the work that we should have done.
Yeah, and you also write in the book, quote, "This message of mattering sounds differently to different people." Again, that's another thing that's sort of getting under, you know, the why of the problem, right?
Right. And so to your point earlier about being in improv and being kind of other focused and present in the moment is the idea that it's like a comparison, right? Like, well, if this person matters, then these other people don't matter. Yeah. That is not the point here. The point of Black Lives Matter, as we have interpreted it, is that we need to focus on a group of people who have been in the margins and those who were in the margins of the margins, so that we can all matter, right? And it's not just an aspiration, but it's a reality. And so the lack of empathy or concern or just this sense that there are people who are not being valued as full human beings gets lost when you don't actually have relationships with people who were racially different than you. And so, you know, which is why at the outset of the book, you know, we take time to demonstrate, to illustrate how disjointed our lives are racially, how segregated our lives are. So, you know, perhaps, right, when you even have more people in your life who are of a different racial identity, then perhaps you're not as concerned of the idea that somehow someone's saying your life doesn't matter, because you love the people who we are talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And we want to talk about those people and how we should all be loved.
I interviewed on the podcast my friend Ashley Nicole Black, and this is when she was writing for Samantha Bee, and they sent her to the Republican National Convention, and she would go up to people and say, do you believe that Black Lives Matter? And they all went, well, all lives matter. And she goes, yeah, so then Black Lives Matter too. Can you say Black Lives Matter? And no one would say it. And it was a very, very funny. But one of the things she also pointed out is, you know, once these people got through their sort of Trumpy talking points, you know, by minute seven, by minute eight, by minute nine, they would have really funny, nice conversations because they saw each other as individuals and as people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important because people don't know what why Black Lives Matter started or how it started. It's just sort of been co-opted as this message that people are changing. So I really want you to talk about what the origin story of that specific progressive movement, you know, how did it happen?
Well, it originated, let's say the dominant story about Black Lives Matter is that after George Zimmerman was acquitted of Trayvon Martin's murder, Alicia Garza wrote, I think on Facebook, you know, she's like part poet and mm-hmm. wrote like a haiku that said, you know, all black, you know, Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. Her colleagues, you know, it just kind of resonated with people. And part of the letter, she was kind of writing this letter to black people that in the wake of that acquittal, people were just kind of like, wait, what? How did that happen? Do we matter? Should we be surprised or disappointed? How should we feel? And so she was kind of writing this love letter to say, you matter, Black Lives Matter. And so, but a year later or so, in the death of Michael Brown, then I don't want to say radicalized, but became more to the forefront that people were using this as a chant, as a protest, and really just kind of mobilizing around the idea that it is becoming increasingly obvious that Black lives matter less in this country. And it's something that Black people have always known, but now we have our cell phones mm-hmm. that people are being able to videotape these instances of violence by, you know, police, but by other citizens. And violence can mean physical violence or verbal violence, you know, even kind of thinking about like telling people to go back where they came from is a certain kind of violence. And so now that people are can't really refute the idea that Black people are treated differently, it's almost like a special moment that people have taken to say, hey, look, we've been trying to tell you this the whole time, and we would like to call your attention to this idea that Black lives should matter in order for us to say that we have an egalitarian democracy.
And I think it's important to note that this is a very different movement that from the civil rights movement in the 60s, especially in the area of like leadership. Because I think we look back at the civil rights movement and we see these iconic Black male leaders, mostly that's who we're looking like King and others. But this Black Lives Matter movement was much more improvisational in that the leadership kind of flowed back and forth between many people.
I know Tehama would have normally answered this, but I just would like, I mean, I was just talking with my students about this. Hmm. And the fact of the matter is that even though we tend to have a dominant idea about Martin Luther King and, Malcolm X as mm-hmm. being these greater, bigger than life, leaders that, and then everyone else kind of followed them, that is actually not a true story in the first place. Mm. And that we learn about certain figures. Every American child knows about Martin Luther King Jr. Every American child knows about Rosa Parks. But the thing is that even then there were local leaders mm-hmm. and there were women and there were queer people who were at the forefront of the community, right? That there were local movements going on across the country and not just the South. So, there actually might be more similarities than we actually tend to see or believe or point to, and that the Black Lives Matter movement has been driven by young people, by mm-hmm. women, by queer Black people, and that it's really focused on people working at the local level to solve the problems of their community. And it's actually not that much different than what the kind of nitty-gritty parts of the civil rights movement, which lasted for decades. It didn't last, you know, from 1960 to 1965 when we got the Voting Rights Act. Right. I mean, there was a big, long development and buildup over decades. That we sometimes forget about.
So this, I mean, then this is a national myth, or maybe it extends beyond our borders. But it's that great man theory, right? That we're always like looking for the one savior leader, and it's never mm-hmm. true. The way people talk about Steve Jobs, it's like he didn't invent this stuff. I mean, it's like he's a great marketing guy and a design guy, but someone else actually invented a lot of these products, and a lot of people worked on them. And we tend mm-hmm. to have this myth, which is not good, and it doesn't work, and it's not true, and it seems to apply to many different areas of our culture.
That's an interesting point. I feel like we're so focused on the individual in our society, the way that we both take credit and the way that we blame. And so, it's not surprising then that when it comes to the idea of leadership, that we look to individuals. And in this case, you know, we're looking around the world and it seems like there's this trend towards strong men, right, taking the helm of these nations, mm-hmm. whereas... Our best times, or at least some people nostalgically think about some of the best times in our country are when people have joined movements and when people have, risen to the occasion together, whatever that may be, right? It's mm-hmm. it's when the people rise together and when they reach out that, we're actually moving mountains, right? Mm-hmm. So we try to emphasize in our book that we are leaderful and that what people do on the local level is real power It is not diminutive, right? It is real. It changes people's lives. And, you know, where it's important, where it's helpful is when, you know, you can think about a national strategy, right? But that we don't need to have a key single figure in order to be legitimate in our cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yep. And it's interesting, this is a very evidence-based book. So you're both academics, and the data is so sobering is too soft a word. You talk about the political scientist Frank Baumgartner, who collected 13 million data points of police traffic stops in North Carolina. 13 million. So that's a lot. That's a lot of data. What did he find?
He found, generally speaking, that young black men and young Latino men, so there's an age component, there's a race component, there's a gender component, are many times more likely to be pulled over by police for innocuous reason, you know, for maybe it looks like their seatbelt's not on or things like that. And these, these being pulled over then leads to more searches. And, you know, people across racial groups do about the same amount of wrongdoing, especially
right.
around drugs. But if you're surveilling a certain amount, you know, you're surveilling particular groups disproportionately, then chances are you're going to find them doing things disproportionately. And so that's just one of that kind of data we point to because it's hard to refute. It's easy to say, we've come a long way. Why are we still complaining about this? But when you have 13 million data points that show you again and again that some people are more likely to be targeted in all sorts of ways, it's just, you know, our goal is to make it hard for people to not know.
Right. Go ahead.
If I could just add one thing there is that it's not even like to point to the pattern, right? That when we're talking about structural racism, we're talking about patterns, we're talking about practices, right? So that when you put all those individual data points together, there is a likelihood that a certain thing is going to happen. And one thing that they found in this study is that there's even a greater likelihood that black people will be stopped at certain times of the day, 5 p.m., right? I mean, like when you talk about like it's almost ritual, right? Like, and so it's that's where statistics can be really helpful. It doesn't do everything. Statistics shouldn't do everything, but when they can pinpoint there's a greater likelihood that a certain type of person is going to get pulled over at a certain time of the day by the police, like we need to take heed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And also in terms of the statistics, it's an FBI data set that there were, and this is in 2015, there were around 7.5 million people arrested for about three dozen crimes, ranging from violent crimes to vagrancy. So actually very few people, relatively speaking, are committing crimes, because I looked up the U.S. population at the time, which was 321 million. So then how do you explain that 67% of the U.S. prison population is people of color? I mean, it's so out of whack.
It is so out of whack. And it's right. Those people aren't just, the people who are in prison aren't just being arrested for things that happened in 2015, right? They're serving these long, disproportionately excessively long sentences for things they did back in the 80s, right? I mean, just like things that are being decriminalized currently, you know what I mean? Like, it's absurd. It's profane. It's horrible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we all saw that Felicity Huffman got, you know, 2 weeks of prison time. And, you know, you've got an African-American woman who's serving 5 years for trying to get her kid into a better school. I mean, come on.
Right. Yeah.
And so some of these structural issues that go back, I honestly didn't know. And I want you to talk this about housing in particular, because I had heard the term redlining, but I didn't really know what it meant. And as I've been sharing this, you know, item from your book with people, they are aghast. They had no idea that this was in place. So talk about the Homeowners Loan Corporation and what they did ages ago and how it is affecting us today.
So the Homeowners Loan Corporation came out of, well, after the, after, so this is really, after the Great Depression, there was really a change in ideas about what the American government should do to help poor people, because at that time, all sorts of people that never thought they were going to be poor were. And it, you know, changed people's ideas about what the government should do. So one of the things that they did was they wanted to make sure that more people owned their homes. And it used to be the case that you had to put a whole lot of money down and you know, like basically pay for your house in cash, which that's like the idea of any of us doing that now is mind-boggling, mm-hmm. right? And so the mortgage structure that we have, that kind of 30-year mortgage structure that we have now, came out of these programs after mm-hmm. the Great Depression. Anyway, so in trying to figure out who they could give loans to, the government wanted to assess risk. And so one of the ways that they assessed risk was where people of color and where white middle-class people and white working-class people were living. And ultimately, they determined that places where black people lived were not safe places to invest or safe places to give loans. And they made these maps, and the places where people of color lived were red. And so they didn't give loans to people who lived in red areas. But of course, there are also another series of policies that said that black people could only live in the red areas and white people could not live in the red areas. Mm-hmm. So what that meant is that the federal government and state governments were loaning money for people to give to buy homes, but primarily to white folks because they could live in the non-red areas and they weren't giving them to black people. And so we know now that the biggest way that people build wealth is either intergenerationally. So someone gives you something,
yep.
they give you a pot of money or they give you a home, or through the equity in your house. And so now, even if you overlay the maps that were made in the 1930s and 40s on American cities today, you can highly predict what kind of people by race are going to live in what neighborhoods. And so, you know, you see like, oh, well, there's a black neighborhood and there's a white neighborhood. It's not because black people like to live next to all black people necessarily, but because there are a series of policies that prevented people from moving about, from buying homes when and where they wanted to. One of the things I like to mention is that even where we have trees planted mm-hmm. is influenced by those maps that were made in the 1930s. So if you go to a poor neighborhood, and a poor black neighborhood especially, chances are there are not going to be any trees. Whereas in wealthy neighborhoods, you probably notice that there are tree-lined streets. And even today, cities will say, well, we can't afford to plant trees because we have to take care of the older trees that we planted in the 30s. So, you know, these kind of things have influence on air quality, right? We see asthma, we see, you know, toxins and pollution in places where there are fewer trees. So these maps that were made by the Hulk to decide who was safe enough to give a home to and where are having all sorts of ramifications even today about wealth inequalities, health, environmental racism, where people go to school, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, so I heard this. We had a medical crisis in my family, and in talking with the folks at the hospital over the year and talking about, you know, what is the best predictor of healthcare success otherwise, and they said your zip code.
Zip code. Your zip code can be more predictive than your genetic code.
I mean, that's for a number of reasons, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, mostly these kinds of things, right?
Right.
Your zip code, you know, where are their sidewalks? Where are their hazardous waste sites? Where are their trees? Where are their highways? These are highly predicted by zip code, and your zip code and the race of the people who live there are highly correlated.
You also tie this to education, of course, and I found this stat kind of wild. Quote, the proportion of black students going to majority white schools nowadays mimics the figures from 1968. I mean, how is that possible?
Well, that's made possible by the decline of court-ordered desegregation, which starts to happen in 1990, and the trend continues in a kind of a strong way until like 2011 or so. So that the kinds of gains that, as a person, so I was born in 1979, that I benefit from the, you know, from the busing, right? I benefit from that sense of like that the schools are having to be more accountable, all right, to a more diverse population. This tapers off by the time, right, I'm in college. So there's this whole generation that's coming up that has a very different, you know, structural reality than I did in education. So it's just, and also that now we have, maybe it's more stark because the majority of public school students are not white, right? Mm-hmm. This generation that's being born today is majority non-white, right? It's majority people of color. Mm-hmm. And those folks are more likely to go to public schools. So, and you continue, however, also to have mostly white teachers in the schools. So there is, I mean, this is where a lot of people would say, right, that schools, public schools in particular, are the laboratory of, like, our citizenship, right? And then this is how citizens are being made. So when citizens are being made in a wildly segregated, sites where there are disparate resources, then that's the kind of thing that they can anticipate for the rest of their lives in the United States, right? That mm-hmm. there are certain people who get certain things, that there are the way that they are literally graded, right? The opportunities that are in front of them are going to be structured in this way. And it is very telling because it's also, you know, that's the schooling thing is very much tied into the neighborhoods, right? Who lives there. So all of these things, what we try to do in, you know, chapter one, right, is like create this constellation of how this whole system works together, mm-hmm. right? The schools are connected to where people live. Are they building wealth? What kind of wealth is going back into the schools, right? I mean, they're all connected.
Yep. You also, I think it's the second chapter where you do a glossary and you do it early. And I'd love to talk about that because, again, these terms get thrown around all the time. And I don't know, and certainly the way you lay it out is like, here's what it means in this context and potentially in this context, and here's how it gets misused potentially. So talk to us about what is intersectionality? That gets used a lot, and I don't think everyone understands what it means.
I'll say what it doesn't mean first.
Okay.
It doesn't
start there.
Because it does get thrown around a lot, and people say things like, I'm intersectional because I'm a woman, and I'm a student, and I'm a this, and I'm a that. And that's not what it is. Mm-hmm. Intersectionality helps us, is a concept that helps us to understand that a black woman and a white woman might do the exact same behaviors and be treated differently for them. Mm-hmm. That that a policy that is meant to help everyone could have totally different outcomes. So I'll give you an example. If you were, Kelly, if you were a person in a domestic violence situation, if you're a woman in a domestic violence situation, mm-hmm. what might you do? How might you respond?
I'll call the police.
You'd call the police. If you were an undocumented woman, what would you do?
Oh, I would not call the police.
You would not call the police. No. So this is what intersectionality helps us to understand, mm-hmm. is that by being placed in various groups that maybe you're an immigrant or undocumented or black or woman or queer, that you are going to walk through life. You can walk through very similar situations and have totally different experiences.
We have a program that I help lead called the Second Science Project with the University of Chicago, where we study behavioral science through the lens of improvisation, and we've done some D&I work, and much of it is based on this, like, that people really crave to be seen as they see themselves, which is different than I think the way I previously imagined, where it's like, oh, you want to be seen as your best self, your prettiest self, but I think that does strike at, no, you need to see my truth, because my truth is probably a lot more complex than you understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So interesting. Okay, the other, and I was very curious about this one again because my buddies at University of Chicago, they have issues with the term microaggressions in terms of the validity. I'm sure you've heard that, but you know, describe what it is, and then let's talk a little bit about why some people think that like it's not a thing. It maybe is. I don't know. I'll say problematic, but that's probably a bad word.
Right. I laughed a little bit because I'm an alum of University of Chicago.
And, yeah, you know who I'm talking to.
Yeah, I do. And so the microaggressions, the concept that's trying to get across with microaggressions is that when all the slights, all the insults, the backhanded compliments, that these, when totaled up over a person's lifetime, right, they become meaningful in a particular way, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That they send messages that they're not treated as discrete interactions that just happen between this one person. But again, to get to the idea that there's some kind of pattern of how some people get treated and how others get treated, that's why I think the concept of microaggressions is useful, mm-hmm. is to think that people's perceptions are differently shaped, the way they experience their reality is differently shaped by, right, these totaling incidences over time. Right. And so where, you know, University of Chicago gets off on the microaggression tip, as I understand it, as an alum who reads the alum magazine and everything, is that that there should be, right, free speech, or that there should be freedom of thought, that people should have to defend their ideas, right? That University of Chicago prides itself in being a university of ideas, and that the better idea wins out. And, you know, that appeals to me in a really strong way. What also appeals to me is that we should be mindful of that we are not all living the same reality, right? And that when people say certain things in class, that it'll fall differently on different ears, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so these are kind of the efforts. Chapter 2, our whole point really is to like put out on the table that, first of all, we're not using the same words, or we're using words to mean different things, rather, that there are concepts like microaggression, like intersectionality, like black girl magic, that were necessary to be coined because they put a kind of a linguistic feature on something that people experience,
mm-hmm.
and that when we can name it linguistically, then we can share it, right? Like,
right.
Like language is ideology. Like, we think through language, and if we have a term coined for these things, then we can discuss them, like, empirically. We can say, this is a thing that happens to people. And now I know that, like, all those times that those insults added up over time, oh, this other person understands that too because they've had a similar phenomena in their life, right?
So there's a great example of this that's happening right now, which is like every time Joe Biden opens his mouth, right? I mean, because it's just like he clearly doesn't – he thinks he's so woke. He really does. And he just keeps saying these things that reveal just a complete misunderstanding and ignorance of his role historically, his – right? I mean, is like the corn pop thing was like, I can't believe this is happening. You know, it's like almost every week some terrible thing. And you know, like Joe Biden is like, seems like he's probably a nice guy, but he does not understand his racism.
There's so many things I could say about him, but yes, he's he is a candidate, is what he is. That's what he is.
But you get what I mean, too, because it's like it's almost like a cartoon character, because it's so like he's, you know.
It's very predictable.
It is very predictable. Yeah.
In fact, everybody has predicted it. Everyone knows that Joe Biden was going to be this way.
Yeah.
So we're not at all surprised. We're just dealing with it differently. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Before I'm going to ask you each for a yes and story. That's how we always end the podcast. So, you know, a time in your life when you probably would have said no, but instead you said yes and to it. And I'll give you a second to think about that. But I do want to... You mentioned colorblindness, and I think it's really important because this is like a dominant feature. And it's like those times where, you know, someone sort of gets called out for being racist, and they're like, I voted for Obama. Like, what, you know? And this is a big issue because it is I don't know. It's like in the past when I was taught about the difference between Southern racism and Northern racism. And, you know, sometimes when you see the Confederate flag out front, at least you know what you're dealing with. And, you know, from where I grew up in the North here, it was much more sort of insidious and underneath. So talk to us a little bit more about this condition of colorblindness and why it's so dangerous.
So, you know, if colorblindness is the thing where you say, I mean, people sometimes literally say, I don't see color. And it makes us feel good. It makes it seem polite. It makes us sound progressive. It makes us sound inclusive. But the logic of colorblindness says that since race shouldn't matter, it doesn't matter. And it leads us to try to do a lot of mental gymnastics to explain racial disparities without using the word race. Or without actually coming to realize that racial segregation happens in part because of structural racism, and it's not because of, for example, just class. Mm-hmm. And so the reason why colorblind racism is so maybe insidious, dangerous, is because it gives the illusion of justice. Mm. When there's not the actuality of it.
I'm writing down the illusion of justice because that's really beautiful.
Yeah, I like that too.
Trademark that. Hashtag. all right. Tehama, a yes and story.
Oh, God. Okay. I don't even know how to... Wait, how does this work? Yes, and.
I mean, it's like you think about... All right. So people's... You know this. You're in academia. People's default behavior is to either do nothing or say no. And in improvisation, we recognize that. So we have this exercise, and it's ingrained where, like, you can't... When you are improvising with someone across from them, and you can't stop at yes. You can't just say yes. You have to say yes, and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Okay. So you got to have something from your past where... You went for it.
Where I went for it.
I can go first.
Oh, there we go. That's fine.
Yes, okay. And go. Okay.
So actually, I think that this book is a product of a yes and. Mm. And the reason why I say that is because Tehama and I didn't necessarily agree on a number of things in writing this book. And one of the conversations that we had was whether we really believe that the U.S. could become a post-racist society, or was it even worth thinking about that? And I was kind of like, nah, I'm good. in my heart of hearts would say, nope, we just need to burn it all down and start it all over. Mm-hmm. And Tehama really encouraged me to, you know, say maybe what we need to do is to orient ourselves toward the thing that we want and start walking and moving and doing the thing that, doing the things that would get us closer to the ideal situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's lovely. That's definitely a yes and. All right, you've had time, Tehama.
Now I need... Okay, so I think this is a yes and, but I could be totally screwing this up.
Go for it.
Okay, I'm taking yes and as a thing where, like, I understood something a certain way, and then I also, especially in talking with Candace and in reflecting with Candace, that I started thinking also additionally, right?
Yeah.
So over the summer, I'm at a supermarket with my 3-year-old daughter, and I've pulled into the parking lot, and I'm getting her out of the car, the back seat, and this man pulls right in next to me in the space that's empty, but he pulls in like quick, like too quick. It's dangerous. He shouldn't be doing it. So as he gets out of the car, I say to him, it's really important that you slow down when you come into a spot like this. I said, I was just standing here getting my kid out. And he turns to me, and he starts walking away, and he says, quit your bitching. Mm. And I'm like, no, he got the wrong one here. So I get her out of the car, and I'm walking towards the supermarket because I'm going to confront this man. Because this is what I'm going to do. And I, when I'm walking in, lo and behold, he has gone in just quickly to go get a coffee. And by the time I got my kid into the cart and we're in there, I see him. And as soon as I see him, now this is a white man, and this is important for me to say that, right? He is a white man, and I look for an employee because I want somebody to witness what I'm going to say to him. And the first person I see is a black woman. And I said, can you please come over here? So she comes right over, right? And I say, ma'am, this man spoke to me inappropriately in the parking lot. And she listens to me. She listens to him. She's like as fair as a person can be, right? And I am mad.
Yeah.
Right? I am hot mad because now I'm also thinking about how my kid is being treated in this moment. And I say, you know, how dare you speak to me this way? That's inappropriate. You need to apologize to me. And he looks at this black woman and he says, oh, I apologize to her. And I said, no, you didn't. And he says, I'm sorry. Looking at the black woman again, I'm sorry. I said, no, you need to apologize to me, and you need to apologize to my daughter, because she shouldn't have the experience of somebody speaking to me like that in front of her, right? I am her mother. I'm her role model. So he ends up apologizing to her, and I'm increasingly, you know, like, I'm mad, right? And I look at him, and the last thing I say to him, I said, the patriarchy is over. I don't know. This is my ending point, right? I'm pissed off, and he leaves, right? And now another black woman who works there is standing there, and they're bearing witness, right?
Yeah.
But they're bearing witness to my anger, and they're allowing me to be angry. So this is a yes and, because I called Candace after this, and I'm telling her how angry I am, right, about what happened. I'm processing this, right, because somebody hasn't told me anything about me being a bitch in a really long time, right? I guess when you're a professor, people don't say this as much to you, right, to your face, anyway. Right. And in the process of talking to Candace, because I'm speaking to a black woman when I'm talking to Candace, right, it occurs to me that I am being privilege in this moment, right? Because it's my anger and my feelings that are being allowed to be, right? And it is in talking to her that I become attentive to the fact that these are opportunities in which black women, right, in a similar situation, need to be able to get it off their chest, what's happening, right, the injustice, the slight, whatever it is, and for people to hear them, right, for people to have... because this is a very human moment, right? Like, this whole thing went down rather peacefully. But we need to create that space. And so, you know, these were thoughts that were percolating in my mind, but it's only in having, like, an interracial conversation that, like, completely comes to the fore, right?
Yeah.
Like, we need to have more of these moments. And you know, Candace in the process is also letting me breathe, right?
Sure.
And then she's like jumping. She's giving her analysis on this, right? And she's pointing out things about me, right? Like, this is crucial for how I think how we develop compassion and awareness and a little humility, maybe, right?
Yeah.
So, this is the yes and that comes to mind, and I hope it's also an indication that, like, you know, I love my co-author. She is my dear friend. She, this book has been, we like to say we downloaded our brains into a book, and this is what we came up with together. But the process is much more heartfelt and sustaining, and it's been really life-giving to me. Like, my life is so much better because she's in it.
It's an excellent book. It's called Stay Woke, A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter. Tahame and Candace, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. I love you too, Tay.
We're leaving that in. Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.